Okay. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to stand. I don't know if I'm going to sit. Let's see how this feels. Yeah, Barb's handing me my notes. Okay, my name's Jenny. I'm anorexic.
Hi, Jenny.
Okay, like I've been thinking about speaking at this meeting since we started this meeting, and I was like, well, I'll be one of the reserve people if they have a speaker cancel, and then it kind of, like we need a prudent reserve of speakers, I don't know, and then it kind of came up periodically throughout the month of December and late November that maybe I should speak this month. And I didn't really think anything of it. I wasn't nervous. I wasn't stressed until last night when it became like an official, like now I'm officially going to speak. And then I started shaking like I was a small dog in a previous life or something, like shaking. And about 6 o'clock, I broke out in this lovely rash on my throat. And you know, the only reason I really point these things out is because these are physical reactions that my body does, has always done from the time I was itty bitty little. Like I wear my anxiety on my sleeve. Everybody around me can see it. You know, I'm not one of those silently nervous persons. I'm the one that turns cherry red tomato in front of the room and trips and stutters. And what's changed for me in recovery is that does not cause me excruciating shame anymore. Like now I can have those physical reactions in my body and just go, yup, that's my body, that's me. You know, so already 2 minutes into my talk, I can tell you one of the gifts of the program for me. I want to qualify because that seems to be a popular trend in OA these days. I have been abstinent for seven plus years now, and I've been sober for 17. And weight, you know, I'm not very good about a low because I'm not really quite good at remembering numbers when I'm starving. Like, I'm not quite good at remembering anything when I'm starving. So I guess I can't really tell you an honest, because by God, it's got to be honest, low. Maybe 110. I'm about 5'11". So it's skinny, skinny. Like, I found a picture of me when I first walked into program, into OA, when I was like 23 years old, the first time I came to OA, and I was like shocked at how skinny that was, because I was like, oh my God. And my sponsor, I remember like the very first sponsor I had in OA, I went to her house and I was like, I don't know why I was doing this, but I was laying on the floor, like on my side. And I remember like laying on the floor, being all addict and arrogant, thinking, oh, I look so good, right? You know, like, oh, look how skinny and good I look. And her remembrance of that same night was, she's like, I remember you laying there and thinking, oh my God, you're so emaciated. Like, she's so skinny. Like, my perceptions about my body were so warped, you know, and I had no clue, no idea. My story is a story of extremes. Like, I love those guys in the big book, in the first section of the big book, you know, the ones that were like, I'm Traveling Joe, and I had no shoes, and I rode the rails, and I drank vodka from a shoe. You know, like, I love those guys because it made me feel like I belonged right away. Because I have extremes in my stories, and sometimes I feel like I have to edit those extremes because I'll be like, oh, people won't get that. They'll, you know, alienate them. But you know what? They left those books, those stories in the big book for a reason, and so I'm not going to edit my story either. Has the rash, right? Okay, so from the very beginning, my primary relationship was with food, like truly from the beginning. Like this, the mythology of the family, you know, every family has their stories, and the mythology of my family is, you know, oh, you know, Jenny was such a picky eater and she just wouldn't eat anything, you know, and I had like three things that I would eat in my first 2 years of life, you know. My mom would always tell these stories, and my sister, my whole family laughs about how my sister would sit at the table and she would scream, eat, 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 because that was what my dad did to me. Like, he would get so enraged and he'd just be screaming at me to eat, and my sisters would copy it, and it's like a family, like everybody will laugh. If you, you know, if I did that in a room full of my family, they'd think that was the most hilarious thing in the world. But what I learned right away is that by having this relationship with my food, I could control the people around me, and I could control other things. Like, you know, it's like my dad could do all kinds of horrible things to me because he was very abusive, and so was my mom. But I could control him with my food. I could control the food. I didn't have to eat, and he could do nothing but get more and more purple-faced and enraged. He could hit me. He could do whatever he wanted, but he could not get the food down me, and even if he could, he couldn't make it stay there, right? So automatically, already, I had this incredible power that was food. And let me tell you, that relationship became my best friend, like my best relationship, because I didn't learn a lot of tools for living and a lot of coping skills when I was growing up in my household. But I learned that one. That one worked well for me. There was a lot of abuse in my family, I said that, but there was a lot of food abuse, too. Like, a lot of weird torture things. Like, my dad would... I need to be careful because I don't want to like do like a fist up and throw up on you guys necessarily, but lots of, here's the food just out of your reach. Now you can't get it. You know, and I don't know. So again, it reinforced, not only could I control others with food, but they could control me with food too. And food just became the God, like the all-powerful God. A lot of the abuse was God-related too, like ritual-related too, so I had no use for any gods from religion, so food was an ideal god because, you know, there it was all powerful, and I could control you, and you could control me, and nobody's writing about it, nobody's talking about it, but there it is, it's everything. I used a lot of coping skills to escape from my life, and starving was a fabulous one, because not only could you not make me eat, but I kind of felt like you couldn't see me either. Like, the skinnier I got and the smaller my body got, the more I kind of felt like you couldn't see me and you couldn't touch me. And guess what? When you're not eating, you don't feel a whole lot except pain, really, in your body. Like, I didn't really, like, I know I'm bright red, aren't I? I could just be the ghost in the room, you know, like, blend in with the woodwork, and that was fine with me. My goal, when I first got in a program, my sponsor said to me, well, what's your goal weight? And I was like, goal weight? Like, what? Like, who would have a goal weight? And she's like, well, when you're starving, what did you want to get down to? And I'm like, zero? Like, why would you pick any number if you could have no number? Like, that's ideal. And she said to me, but Jenny, even when you're dead, you still weigh something. And you know, that pissed me off. Like, I'm still pissed off about that. Like, that still feels to me like unfair. Somehow, I don't know, you know, so I wanted to disappear, I wanted to go away, and food worked well to help me, because if the less I ate, the less of there was of me, and so I was getting away. I also did a lot of dissociation, and I had big gaps in time in my life that I just wasn't there. Like, I just wasn't present. Like, I remember being in third grade and then walking into my classroom to sit down, and the teacher was like, well, why are you here? And I was like, because this is my classroom. She's like, no, you're in fourth grade. You're in Mrs. Hamilton's room. And I have this big gap, and I'm just like, I have no idea what was there that had happened to me, you know, and that was excruciatingly embarrassing. Thank you very much, because, you know, when you're in fourth grade, you should know that. So I did lots of escaping in a lot of different ways. People picked up on my skinny really fast. Obviously, people noticed those things, you know, because as much as I believed that people couldn't see me, they could. And they would comment about my weight and comment about my food, and then the word anorexic would kind of come up, and well, I wanted to find out what that was, so I went and looked that up, and it started getting into all the girl books, you know, like the Judy Blume books, so that I learned what eating disorders were, you know, from fiction, you know, and it was just like, oh, that's not going to be me. Like, I decided that will not be me. I'm not going to be that. And so I developed a strong aversion to scales. I bragged about how I could care less about calories. I always went for the fattiest, sugariest food. If I was in an eating situation, like a social eating situation, I just get rid of it later, or else I would just limit how much I ate, you know, like, take a big show of bite, you know, and then as soon as the tension was off of me, all the rest would just slip away, you know. But really what I was doing with food isn't so much as just that fact that it was like the relationship in my life, in my world. I didn't have a relationship with the people around me. I didn't have a relationship with a higher power, a God. I had a relationship with food, and that was what my whole world was about, whether I was eating or not eating, how much of it was I eating, what did people think of it if I was eating. But by God, I wasn't weighing, and I wasn't counting calories, so I did not have an eating disorder. And that was very comforting. By the time I got into high school, I had kind of settled into this really nice handy routine. Like the very first time that I got a good, decent, solid exposure to alcohol, to booze, boy, I just was like took to that, like a fish out of water. Like it was like that worked really well for me. Because it contributed to the blacking out and to the not being present. So I used that tool whenever I could. And I know it's kind of funny to say it's a tool, but it was, right? You know, I had a little deal with my friend, and I had a deal with my dealer. Actually, I met these lovely people who dealt a little marijuana and, you know, would get me drunk, and I didn't work and I didn't have a job or anything like that, because why would you do that? I had no motivation to do anything really except escape. And so I would trade babysitting for getting high or drunk. And we would go, and what my dinner would be a super big gulp of pop and my pack of cigarettes and whatever we were doing for the night, like whatever chemical we were doing. And that was, I would say, that's all I need in life. I just need a refrigerator by my bed that's full of Pepsi and booze and cigarettes, and I didn't need food. Like that was like clear to me, like that was not necessary to living or surviving. But the problem with pot is that it makes you hungry. Like, it makes you get the munchies. And so I get really paranoid because I'm like, oh, my God, I look like a dumbass. I'm, like, sitting here with my mouth hanging open, staring into space, thinking about food and wanting to eat. This is not working for me. So I stopped that quickly because I didn't want that to interfere with my, drag me into that eating. I got married. I try not to skip around too much, but you don't want to get into too many gory details either. So I'm working my way through high school with my blackouts through various sources, and I meet this guy when I'm just barely 16. And he was the first guy that had ever really been nice to me. Like, not that I went to a high school where the guys were assholes, but I didn't speak to any of them because I was too, like, I was like, I don't know, one of the three stoners that went to my Catholic high school, and you know, like I walked through the corridors with my head down, and I looked at the floor, and that was it. You know, like I was completely isolated, and I met this guy at a Halloween party at a kegger. He was 25 years old, 21, and he started being really nice to me. Like he was nice, like he bought me things, and he would give me rides, and he would get me drunk without babysitting being involved. And so I was like, dude, I'll marry you, you know, because what else are you supposed to do? That's the next thing you're supposed to do, right? You go to high school, and then you either go to college, which I knew I couldn't do, like I just knew I couldn't do that, and or you get married. So I hung out with him for a few years, and I got married, and then I decided that it would be nice to have a baby. No, I didn't get married. I decided that it would be nice. I was living with him, and I decided it would be nice to have a baby. And I didn't really have a whole lot of use for the whole idea of marriage because, I don't know, I didn't have any money, for one. And number two, I was like kind of this little social outcast, you know, so why would you do that? I got pregnant, and we had a baby. And by this point, I was doing more binge drinking than anything, and my eating was, I don't know, kind of catch as catch can. You know, I mean, when you're young and you don't have the best eating habits anyway, even if you don't have a problem. And I remember, like, every time I go to the doctor, they'd be like, there's protein in your urine. You're not gaining enough weight. And I'd be like, okay. And then I go home. But the baby was measuring okay, so they didn't harass me too much. And I loved the idea that whatever I ate would go to the baby. Like, I was like, oh, I won't gain, like, the baby will get it. And I think I gained, like, 12 pounds in that pregnancy. And she was, like, 7, 12. And I went home from the hospital in my regular jeans. Like, I fit right, now part of that's just being young too, but I fit right back into it, and I went home, and we proceeded to live, and I had another child, and then like everything kind of caught up with me, and I started having nightmares and panic attacks, and I got really super suicidal, like super, super suicidal. So I went into the hospital. I came to Omaha. We lived in Sioux City, and I came to Omaha, and I went into the hospital. And those were the days when you were like in for like 30 days minimum, you know. And I had this friend who was also hospitalized at the same time. She was the one who was like, dude, you're suicidal, you should probably go to the hospital. I'm going too, because I'm suicidal too, right? And she got there before me, and she told him, she's like, she's nuts, please don't put her on the same ward with me. And she was in the chemical dependency program, so they put me in like the general program. And I remember we'd go to groups, and people would say, well, why are you here? And I'd just be like, well, I'm here for everything except an eating disorder. And they'd all be like, don't say that. Like, don't say that. Wow, I might have to speed up. I'm like, it's already been 20 minutes. So I was like just in denial. And that's the first time I learned about 12-step programs, because there was this, they're talking about, you know, addiction and 12-step programms, and they're, you know, telling me about this, you know, don't say you're not here for an eating disorder, and but I was very good at camouflaging my food, you know, and what I was eating, what I wasn't, and couldn't really argue with the weight, but I never got into an eating disorder program, I'll just say that right up front. And for a long time, that was good ammunition for me that I wasn't really anorexic, because I never did actually get stuck into an eating disorder treatment program. So there was more evidence for you that I did not have a problem, thank you. But I met this girl, and she was just like, you have a problem. She knew about my drinking, and I took my last drink in the hospital. It was one of those low bottom moments. They had a bottle of vanilla extract in one of the cupboards that was there just for baking. Man, I found that puppy, I'm just like, score, and I downed it, and I turn around, and here's like this girl that I had met, Kim, and she's just standing there, and she's like, you have a problem. And she hands me a big book, and she's like, you better go and sleep with this under your pillow, because you are screwed if you don't get this. And she's like being all like, you know, tough love, AA, as she walks away. And I take my old hardcover, it's hardcover big book, and I put it under my pillow, and I slept with it under my pillow. Like, I just did, because I started reading it, and I was like, oh, this is something I can relate to. Like, I could relate to the stories, and I could relate to the low bottom, even though I was still in denial. And I was like, that's my problem, is that I'm a drunk. That's my problem. That's it. So I'm like, oh, wow, I'm found. So I get out of the hospital, and I get a sponsor, and she died. She died my first month of sobriety, and I was just like, well, by God, I'm not going to drink over that, because, you know, that'd be a perfect excuse to drink, and I'm going to show them all how good I can do AA, because I wanted to fit in. It was really the first time that I felt like I fit in, that anybody could talk to me, that I could talk back, you know, and I wanted to learn all the rules. I memorized the big book. I mean, I wanted to be like the perfect AA-er. So I get in a program, I start going to program, my sponsor dies, and when I get discharged from the hospital, I'm not going to go back to my husband, right? Because I have figured out, before I came to the hospital, I figured out I'm a lesbian, and no matter what part of me was kind of living life that was kind of like, this isn't right for me. So I'm not going back to him. Well, I didn't have a job, I didn't have money, and I was in a city that I didn't know anybody in. So when that happens to you, for future reference, generally what happens is that you're homeless and you go to a shelter. You don't have money, you don't have a place to live, and you don't know anybody. So I was homeless and I'm living in the shelter, and I remember like how embarrassing that was. Like, here's arrogance. Like, I wasn't like, oh man, I'm homeless, I better do something like to help myself. No, instead I was just like, this is really humiliating. Like, I'm better than this, you know? And I'm looking at these people and I'm just like, good God, you know? I mean, look at these people. I mean, look at what they're, you know? And I remember like the shelter would have this rule, like you had to leave by like 8 a.m. they'd feed you, and then you had to leave, and I'd leave, and then you're supposed to go and spend the day looking for jobs. Well, I didn't do that. I went to meetings. went to a lot of meetings. You know, and I remember calling my sponsor one night, and I was like, I'm gonna drink. I know I'm gonna drink. And she was just like, well, where are you? And I was like, I'm at the shelter. And she's like, and can you leave? And I'm like, no, man, we're on lockdown. Like, you can't leave after a certain hour, else they won't let you back in. And she's like, well, do you have any alcohol? I'm like, no. And she's like, well, then you're not gonna drink. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm not then. And she went and died. But anyway, so I'm going to meetings. And everybody I went to meetings at, they would say to me, I'd walk in, I'd be like, I'm 6 days sober today. And they'd be like, that's awesome. Did you get a job yet? And I'd be like, you're an AA person, and you're supposed to care about my sobriety. And they'd be like, yeah, nice, you know. And every day, I mean, these people were relentlessly obnoxious, you know, like they just hounded me on that job thing, because apparently sober and homeless doesn't cut it. I don't know. So I'm there. I'm sorry, I hope I'm being a good enough OA person, but a lot of my story is just mixed. So anyway, so I'm there. Food-wise, you know, food wasn't a huge issue because they gave you two meals. They gave you a meal in the morning, they gave you a meal at night. Nobody really gave a shit if you did not show up, right? So I didn't have a lot of pressure to eat. And so that was kind of nice. Like, that was kind of a relaxing time in my life, you know? It's kind of weird to say I was homeless and I didn't have any food, and that was great. But the AA people noticed, and they were like, you know, like, here's their mentality. Robot, I'm drunk, homeless, boy, she's starving, she doesn't have no food. We're going to take her out, we're going to feed her. And so we go to a meeting, and I went to meetings constantly, like I said, all the time, and people, total strangers, I didn't even know them, God bless all fellowships, 12-step fellowships, because I call people, didn't even know them, names off a list, you know, that I had gotten, and I'd be like, hey, I'm at the shelter, can you pick me up, can you take me to a meeting, and they'd drive over, and they'd pick my ass up, and they'd drive me, God only knew where, I had no idea where I was going, I knew the name of a meeting, but I had, you know, I'm going to the Live and Let Live meeting tonight. Yeah, that's really not a landmark that a non-program person would know, right, you know, but whatever. And so I'm driving around Omaha, I know nothing about Omaha, and you never knew where I was. We go to the meeting, and then we go to the meeting after the meeting, and they take us out, and we go to Village Inn. I was in Village Inn like 7 nights a week. I ate more Village Inn food with no money than any other person I know, because people would always be like, buying me food, and then they'd be watching to make sure I'm eating, right? Because, you know, I bought the food. Hey, you know, I'm doing a good thing for you, you know, eat up. And so that was really awkward, hard. I mean, you know, what do you do with that? So then I got really good at purging. They're very good at purging, you know, that was very convenient. And then there were people that started noticing, because believe it or not, no matter what program you're in, you kind of start noticing some, you know, mental health behaviors, right? So I had a gal, and she started talking to me about, well, she really talked to me about OA. What she did is she was like, come see me. And she worked at central office, and man, I needed stuff to fill up my time. So I went to see her, and I was busy being Miss AA, you know, and doing good things. So hanging out at the central office was a good thing to do. And I went to the meetings and went to see her one day, and she's like, you know, there's a meeting downstairs. Why don't you go to it? And I was just like, well, yeah, that's good. I don't have anything to do for the next hour or two. And I was like, I didn't know there was a meeting here. And she's like, well, it's an OA meeting. And I was like, OA, what's that? And she's like, that's Overeaters Anonymous. And I just was like, well, yeah, that sounds good. It sounds good to hang out with a bunch of people that are overeaters, because I kind of still knew I had a problem with food, but not because I was anorexic. I thought it might be a good place to lose weight. Surely, you know. So I went down, and this is what I remember about my first OA meeting. Whether it's accurate or not, I don't know. What I remember is a really little room and a really big table, and it was a long, narrow room. And there was this table in the center with this row of chairs, and there were people, and I remember everybody being really big. Now, they probably weren't, but in my distorted sense of self, they probably, you know, like, I can realize, you know, I mean, I don't know what, God only knows. I couldn't even tell you what size these people were or whatever, but I remember being like somehow at the very end of this narrow room and having to run the gauntlet of being hugged by all these big giant people to get out of the room. And it was horrible. Like, it was horrible. I was like, I don't even know why I'm here. This is horrible. But I knew about how 12-step programs work. So then they're talking, and they're like, we're going to go out to lunch, which scandalized me, because I'm thinking, well, my God, that's like a bunch of drunks inviting me to the bar afterwards, you know? But they're going to go to lunch, and this one gal, God bless her, I love her, I don't know who she is, but she was like, well, you wouldn't want to go to lunch with us because you wouldn't want to be seen with us. because you're all skinny, and we're, you know, was the implication. And I was just like, you know, I don't know about you, I don't know about you people, but I do know about 12-step programs, and you can't kick me out. I do know that much. So, yes, hell yeah, I'm going to lunch with you people, whether I like it or not, just to show you, you know. So I went to lunch, and that was my indoctrination to OA. I started going to OA meetings because the more meetings, the merrier, you know, and I'm going, and I get a sponsor, and I start working the steps because that's what, you know, you do. You got to be good. You got to be good at recovery. And I had a sponsor, and she kept saying, we are anorexic. And I kept saying, no. And I was more than happy to sit in a meeting at 110 pounds or whatever and say, I'm a compulsive overeater. My name's Jenny. You know, and boy, I just thought, man, I must look so good to those people because I'm all skinny and I can sit and say I'm, you know, a compulsive overeater. And, you know, and people did, like once, you know, people, some people did, because some in our program, sometimes skinny is healthy. It's not, but not always. But sometimes it is to people. And so some people would think, wow, you know, how long have you been abstinent? I'm like, oh, I'm not abstinent, you know. Or people would be like, well, how much weight have you lost? I'm like, well, no, you know, I mean, and as soon as they talked to me for like 1 second, they knew it was, you know, I was full crap. So I had the sponsor, and she kept, gosh, I've gone through half my notes. I had the sponsor, and she kept pounding on the whole anorexic thing. And I just was like, no. Like, leave me alone. I experimented with all these things to call myself. Like, I created the bulimorexic word, you know, like I was some kind of, I don't know, prehistoric creature or something. I'd be like, hi, I'm Jenny, I'm bulimorexic. Like, anybody's going to be able to figure out what the hell that means, right? You know, it's like whatever barriers I could put up to be separate from you guys, because I was not one of you guys. I just needed to be with you guys. So what happened? This is like truly my step one, because I think that, you know, we go through the steps so many different times, hopefully, in recovery, but there is, I think, maybe not the first time, but at some point, each step has a pivotal moment, like that moment when the fireworks go off and when you really know, I sunk my teeth into that one, I got it that time, you know. So the step one that I got was this, we were out in this park, God bless her, we're out in a park, and she's, we're talking, and she's pounding, you're anorexic. I'm like, I've never cared about weighing. And she's like, but the reason you didn't care about weighing is because you were trying to use that as evidence, you know, and you know, people who don't have an eating disorder don't care about not caring, right? You know, like, that doesn't make any sense. And so, finally, it hits. Like, it sank into me, and it was like a physical reaction. Like, I told you guys that I dissociated a lot, right? And that was a point, I dissociative identity disorder, and that was a point where my first part integrated, and it sank in, and it was like the blinding light. I can't even tell you. It was like a physical reaction, and it hit me that, yes, I was anorexic, and I was filled with rage, and I like got up and I kicked this huge trash can over. Like, usually my MO is meek and quiet and polite and mild and chipper and happy and whatever, and I kicked this trash can over and I go storming off into the park and into the darkness because the sun's setting, and she's kind of like, okay, well, I guess I'll just wait here, I know what to do, right? You know, because we came in the same car, it's like, whatever. And that was really a huge pivotal moment. So after that, I was anorexic, and that was okay, but I was only anorexic here in OA, not in the rest of my life. It was still very compartmentalized. I'm very good at compartmentalizing. That's how I cope with my life. So I was here I was anorexic. Everywhere else I was not. So I proceed, I'm living my life, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm living OA. I had this problem, and here's the problem. When I was, before I came to OA, I had to explain away a lot of my starving, right? And I, you know, when you're starving, you have a lot of weird physiological things that happen to your body anyway, because your body is like, I can't cope without fuel, right? So I had a lot of blood sugar issues, and I had talked to people, and I'd even been to a doctor, and there was, you know, this mention of diabetes. But you know what, you guys, I was not diabetic. But you know what I found out is that if you tell people you're diabetic, they don't try to make you eat sugar. As a matter of fact, they don't even try to make you eat anything because, you know, you're on a diabetic diet. So that became my MO, and I started telling people that, well, I came to OA with that lie. In my mind, I created all this evidence of how it was real, but I came to OA with that intact. So it had never really been a huge issue, but now I've got step one, and I'm starting to work the steps, and I have this lie that I have told every human being alive about. Like, I had a test kit. I would, like, I look back now, and I'm like, was I nuts? Like, yes, I was nuts. Like, I would check my blood sugar 3 times a day because I was being a good diabetic. Like, what the hell, Jen, right? I spoke from an OA podium on step one and my diabetes. That's, oh, talk about embarrassing in hindsight, because obviously, you guys, you know, this came out eventually. I capped to it, but years later, I met a woman, and she was like, you know, that talk inspired me. And she's like, I remember you from, you know, whatever year convention, you know, and that really changed me because I was something I was struggling with, and it inspired me, it gave me hope and courage and helped taught me. And I was just like, yeah, it was a lot, but I didn't say that. I mean, it was just like, just goes to show, you never know what's going to happen, you know. But so anyway, so I had this huge lie, and here I'm working a program of honesty, I'm living a program of honesty, but I have this huge lie. That's excruciating. If you haven't tried it, I suggest you don't. Like, it's horrible to live with lies anyway, but it is excruciating to live with lies in program. My God, excruciating. But I couldn't tell anybody because now this thing was bigger than me. Like, it was bigger every, you know, it was like every time I talked to somebody, it seemed like it would come up, and then I'd have to find a way to cover it, and, you know, and it was just, you know how they are, they just grow. So I had this barrier, and then I also had this huge God issue, because the God of my understanding was brutal and torturous and mocking and mean and looked an awful lot like my parents, and, you know, and I, you know, a lot of things that bring people comfort religious-wise were symbols of torment for me, triggered me, you know, into flashbacks, into nightmares, into whatnot, and I couldn't cope with it. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do I get this higher power that's going to save my ass? And I just couldn't do it, you guys. Like, I just couldn't do it. Between the lie and between this huge barrier of a higher power, I mean, one of my first meetings, I said, very firstly new to OA, or to AA, actually, and I was on step two or three, and I was just like, I hate God, and I don't believe him, and the room was totally silent. And I remember thinking at the time, like, ha-ha, I've shocked them all with my anger. And you know what? They were just being quiet because that's what we do when we're waiting to see if people are going to keep talking, right? You know, like, they were just like, okay, she's done. Thanks, Jen, you know. So anyway, I had these two huge things. I had this lie, and I had this God issue, and so I left program. And I didn't leave program, like, suddenly. I almost got to 5 years, and I was abstinent, and if you can say working a food plan and abstinence based on this core lie, abstinent, but, you know, I'm doing, you know, everything. But what I did to leave program is that I just left it one day at a time, the same way I joined it. One day at a time, I skipped the meeting. One day at a time, I removed my service positions. I, you know, started putting off the sponsees. I stopped picking up the phone. Like, all the things that, all the tools that really create our lives in program, I just simply stopped doing. It was very simple, actually. It was very subtle. It was very sneaky. It wasn't big and dramatic, which is a first for me, because usually I do things big and dramatic and extreme. It just crept up on me. And in my brain, I was still working the steps. I was still in program, because I was always going to just go to that meeting tomorrow. I still had all my literature. I even called my former sponsor, who is still my sponsor in my mind, and I said, hey, will you give me my 5-year chip? She said, sure, come on to a meeting. I think I'd been to a meeting in like 8 months. And I was like, okay, well, I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you on that one. Now, the thing is that for whatever reason, I didn't drink, and I also just doing a lot of therapy. I'm still going to therapy and still working on this whole integration thing. I think it gets foggy, but and my food kind of looked relatively normal for quite a long time. Like, I actually didn't relapse in any extreme big way. And I actually made it quite a few years, probably 4 years maybe, without a big, huge, dramatic relapse. But my life was sucking. Like, I was failing classes at school, and my personal relationships were a nightmare, and I was working in mental health because, of course, that's where all good addicts should be, right? And I'm working in mental health, and my patients had always said to me when I was working a program, like, people would say to me, there's such a light. There's such a light about you. You know, there's such a peace and a calm. That's what they'd say to me. Like, you know, not every day, but just interactions periodically. And that went away. Like, people stopped saying that to me. You know, I remember distinctly noticing that there was something about that life that just went away. But I didn't have this huge big relapse or this big splash until my mom got sick. My mom got cancer. And she got cancer really big and really bad, and she died really, really fast. Like, she was diagnosed on, like, Mother's Day, and she died, like, August 1st. So fast, big. And with cancer and with dying in general, dying people don't eat. That's good for them, right? You know, I mean, once you're, like, in that death process, it's like your body's shutting down, and food just interferes with that process. But if you're living and watching the person die, generally not eating is not helpful. But that's what I did. The less she ate, the less I ate. And by the time she died, I had lost, I don't even know. You know, guys, I'm sucky about numbers. I lost a lot of weight. I would go to work. And remember how I prided myself about not being obsessed about the numbers? I was obsessed about the numbers. I worked in a hospital. It was a mental hospital. It was still a hospital. We had scale on every unit. And I would go to work, and I would check in. And as soon as I could, I would get away from the desk, and I would go, and I'd weigh myself. And then I'd step off the scale, and I'd be like, did that really say what it said? Did it really weigh what I think it said, like 130 or 120 or whatever it was? And I'd have to get back on. And then I'd get off, and I'd get back on. And I'd get off and get on, get off and get on, get off and get on for like 5 minutes straight. And I'd be like, I've got to go back to work, I've got to go back to work. So I'd leave the exam room, and I'd go and sit down at a desk, and I'd start thinking, maybe that scale's wrong. Maybe I need to go check the scale upstairs. So then I'd go upstairs to the ICU, and I'd go into their exam room, and I'd start the whole process over again. I'm obsessing, obsessing, obsessing about the weight. But I couldn't remember. I couldn't think clearly. I couldn't be coherent. I started passing out. I'm driving. When I got into recovery the second time, what we classified that as driving drunk, basically. I wasn't drinking at that point because I'm still sober. But I'm driving so dizzy because my electrolytes are so off, and I've been passing out all day. Like, my God, it's a miracle that I didn't kill somebody, truly, like getting behind the wheel. Food just became an obsession. At some point in my career, I think I left it out, you know, I would go and I'd buy all this food and I'd fill my kitchen with it, and I'd spend like $100. I mean, at that point I was on disability, I didn't have any money, you know, I'd spend every penny I had in food stamps on my food, I'd stuff my kitchen full of food, and then I'd just sit and watch it rot. You know, and oh gosh, I felt so powerful because, ha-ha, you couldn't make me eat that food, you know. So I became obsessed with this weight and with these calories, and I'm passing out, and it's like my life is falling apart. So I called my old sponsor, and I'm like, I need to come back. I need to come back to OA. I don't know what to do. Actually, maybe she called me, and she was like, come be a support to me. I think that's what it was. She was like, I'm having a hard time. Why don't you, can you come over and be supportive of me, having no idea what I'm doing? So I come over, and I like fall apart in her house, like basket case, right? So now here's this slow crawl back into recovery. Embarrassing, right? More than half the people I knew the first time around weren't even here anymore, right? Most of the people that were here didn't even know me, so it's not like they're going to be embarrassed. They didn't know me from Eve, but just embarrassed, sitting in that meeting and just thinking of, oh, the pride, you know, and oh, how many years of abstinence I would have had if I hadn't left, you know, still arrogance intact. Can't walk, can't stay present, but, you know, got to be arrogant. I remember sitting in the meeting, and I had my little cough drops because I had a cough, and I was so excruciatingly embarrassed that I had to take these cough drops because they weren't sugar-free. And I remember like trying to sneak them into my mouth and like hiding the papers and burying the papers in the trash can later after the meeting so that people wouldn't see how many cough drops I'd eaten. I mean, like, dude, I was sick. So obviously now I'm back in program. The first thing that I have to tackle is because most of the people are gone, but there's still enough people around that they know that lie. Remember that awkward diabetes lie that's been carrying me around? So I start working the steps, and I get the steps four. I do a fourth step and do a fifth step, and I do a fifth step, and here I am. I'm like, okay, God. I've kind of skirted the whole God issue, but I've kind of come to some kind of peaceful resolution enough to move on with the steps. So I get to step four and five, and I'm writing my step, or doing my fifth step, and writing my fourth, and that diabetes lie comes to my mind. And I'm like, you know what? I just haven't mentioned it. Like, it's just a non-issue. Like, we don't talk about it, even though this is my old sponsor who knew full well about it. We don't just talk. It just doesn't come up. So maybe I just don't have to mention it. Like, we just won't mention it. And I do my fifth step and get through the whole fifth step, and it's not on there, so I don't have to say it because I'm only reading what's written, right? And then she says, I'm going to give you a minute. I'm going to leave the room, and I want you to pray, and I want you to think if there's anything that you need to say, anything that you left out that you need to tell. And I'm like, fuck. Oops. I've done so well up till now, but that really was a fuck moment. So she leaves, and I'm like, okay, God, is there anything you want me to say? No, nothing. Okay, great. You know, and then like it comes to the forefront of my mind. It's like, I need to tell this, and it's like, nope. No, I'm sure I don't, and I have all my little rationalizations, and I packed it back down again in its box, and then I'm like, anything else? And it's like, the diabetes lie. It's like, no, I'm going to pack that back down in the box, you know? So she comes back, and I said, no, nothing. I got nothing. Those are the words that came out of my mouth. Like, God help you, Jen. Good God, what are you going to do? And so then we're like, I don't know, we small talk, and we go to the bathroom, we're washing our hands, and I'm kind of like standing there like ants in my pants, because I'm telling you guys another big mistake that you don't ever want to do in programs. So you don't want to lie on a fifth step, man. It will kick your ass. Like, that's your one chance to bear it all. And if something comes to your head, just say it. Even if you don't think it matters, even if you don't, no matter what rationales you have, you got to say it, because you will never stay abstinent if you don't. You won't, I swear to you. So I'm like ants in the pants, and I know this. Like, I know that if you lie, you're screwed. So finally I tell her, I blurt it out, and I tell her. And of course she was just like, well, honey, good God, all that excruciating pain you've gone through all those years with that lie. Like, it didn't hurt me. I'm like, I'm so sorry, I hurt you. You know, it's like, no, you hurt yourself. And really that's always the lesson for steps four and five for me. It's like, that stuff is the stuff I hurt myself with. Like, this is the stuff I've damaged myself with. I always get it backwards. I always think that the stuff that's my fault, the stuff that I think is my fault isn't. And the stuff that I think isn't my fault is. You know, I get it totally ass backwards. So that was really kind of that pivotal moment, that come to Jesus moment for fourth and fifth steps for me. It was like, oh, don't lie. Now, honesty is a step one principle, and it took me a while to get that, but that's okay. I got it eventually. Now, steps two and three, how are we on time? Okay, if you get bored, just wave at me, and I'll wrap it up. Steps two and three, okay, so I had this huge God issue, and I didn't even know how I was going to do that. We settled on good orderly direction for me. That worked really well, because for me, I could not be somebody that said everything happens for a reason. Because I had this horrible past that was really, truly excruciating and haunting my every moment. I mean, like, there were years when it was like, I want to kill myself. Like, I would call people sitting in my car and say, I cannot get out of my car. Like, I can't bring myself to get out of my car. I mean, mental illness, and the people in this program had a lot of tolerance for that, you know. Like, the help I needed went way beyond just program. People were very patient and loving with me. And I just could not believe in a God that would say, well, you'll suffer now, but it's all for the good later. Like, that just did not work for me. And I remember for the longest time, like, we just settled in good orderly direction, and my prayer was just like a meditation of action. I would go out and I would throw the ball for the dog. And we actually kind of joked about it, because dog is God spelled backwards, right? You know, so I'd go out and I'd just throw the ball. And I'd throw the ball and I'd just say, God, help me. just help, I need help. And that's all I would do. I remember at one point I had just a little simple prayer. You know, it wasn't anything formal because the formal stuff just made me break out in rashes. And it was on the door frame. And I'd have to stop and I would just read that before I could get the courage to even walk out of the house some days. So the answer for me, like that pivotal moment for steps 2 and 3 for me was getting that good orderly direction. And what I came to is that the power that I, or the God that I trusted was a God that if I was at the stoplights and it was red and I walked out into traffic, that God would not save me. That God didn't have any power to save me. I didn't trust that a miracle would happen because those didn't exist in my world. But the higher power that I could trust would say, the light's red, don't step out into traffic. And I settled on a higher power that could say to me, yeah, this situation sucks, nothing we can do about it, but here's the path that's of least pain. Like, this is the path that's going to get you through the best way that you can get through. And that higher power has been like a firm bedrock for me. It's been something that I can trust no matter what's happening to me. Like, I don't have to worry about that when bad things happen to good people, because you know what? Bad things just happen because that's the way the world is. And I have a higher power that's centered in my core that gets me through no matter what's happening to me. You know, and I had to find that for me. I had to figure that out for me. And I firmly believe that every single one of us has that sense of a higher power that we can come into contact with. And for some people, it looks like songs on the radio. Like, I used to have kind of contempt for people. If whoever's out there, or you guys who hear that, like, I'm sorry. That was judgmental, you know. But, you know, people would be like, oh, I turned on the radio and God sent the perfect song to me. And I just think, what a cotton candy fluff of a God. You know, like, I was just like, dudes, I need a fierce God, not somebody who communicates through, you know, the Beach Boys, right? But that works for them. That is them, you know. There is no room for judgment when it comes to higher power. The other thing that I've learned about higher powers is that all those false gods that I have found throughout my life, you know, my parents, sponsors, therapists, food, you know, substances of any kind, all of those things had an element of higher power in them. Like, I was drawn to them for a reason, because there was some aspect of that did connect me with God. But I just got confused. I just got mixed up. And so what I've learned is, instead of condemning myself for dubbing a human being a higher power, I look at what element, what aspect of that person reminds me of my higher power, and I use that to remind myself of how to connect again. You know, when I do steps 2 and 3, one of the biggest things, one of the most important things, one of the biggest questions that I ask myself is, how do I hear God and how do I know God's hearing me? Because steps 1, 2, and 3 for me are about forming a relationship with a higher power. And if I don't have that relationship, if I can't communicate in that relationship, I can't have a relationship. I have to have a way to communicate. Well, my Nazis are like, yes, Jen, we've heard this 1,000 times from you, right? So that was really pivotal to me, and I had to find a higher power that I could hear and be heard from. So that was core for that. I talked about 4 and 5. 6 and 7 a little bit, just having that ask backwards, the whole, you know, taking responsibility for what's mine and not taking getting it backwards and taking what's not mine and not taking what is. There's something about the stuff that's mine that I never want. It's like it's stinky or something. Like, I'm like, oh, that's mine? It must be inferior. It must be less than, because I am less than, and by association it must be that then. So I'm always forever pushing away the stuff that belongs to me, the stuff that's mine, and trying to take all your stuff. And let me tell you, it doesn't make friends, right? I mean, you guys are like, get off my shit, it's my stuff, right? You have your own. And I'm like, no, I don't want my own, I want yours. Like, it's like I have three, you know? And that's been the biggest thing for me now, is like 6 and 7, is like learning that my stuff is my stuff, and it's good enough just because it's my stuff. Even my bad stuff. Like the 7-step prayer, you know, when we talk about it, it's like you have all of me, the good and the bad. I say that now, it brings me so much peace. You know, it brings me so much peace to say, even the stuff that I have that's bad, it's still part of me, and that's enough. That's good enough. That's okay. Because there's not this fatal flaw in me. I'm not like this soulless that's really what it was when I came in the program. I was soulless. Like, there was no me. And what was me was there was nothing to it. And that's what working the program and doing those steps has given back to me. It's given me an acceptance of all that I am, good and bad, enough and good and not enough. You talk about, I promise myself I'd make it through the steps, so you're going to have to endure just 5 more minutes or so. Steps 8 and 9, that for me, the whole learning about forgiving, because I talked to you guys, you know, I had these abuse issues, and I had such rage, even once I figured out the whole God thing, like, I figured out, like, how can I possibly forgive this? Like, how can I sit and say to these people, you know, I forgive you? Because step 8's all about forgiving. You don't move on to making amends until you forgive. So now I was screwed, right? So how do I forgive? And there were 3 things that really kind of happened. And they weren't necessarily aha moments. They were more like aha years. One thing that happened is that my aunt made amends to me. Now, my aunt called me up, and it was one of the lowest moments in my life, just in my personal life, not because of her. And she called me up, and I answered the phone, and she's just like, she's working another 12-step program. She's like, Jenny, I just need to make amends to you. And she tells me the story about how she had walked into the room one night, and shortly before or after some abuse had taken place, and she said, I knew. I saw what happened, and I knew that your parents were abusing you. and I didn't do anything about it. I turned my back and I walked away, you know, and she was like, you're like 7 years old, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, what, who the fuck is sponsoring you? Like, that was my first reaction, because it was like, this is not helpful to me at all, like, just so you know. But I didn't say that to her, obviously, you know, because, you know, what do you say to somebody at that point, you know? I said, what I knew was right to say is, like, I forgive you. And I hung up the phone, and I'm like, well, now I'm really scared because I told her I forgive her, but I really don't. I'm really mad at her, right? And at some point along the line, I'd had this kind of realization. And the realization was this. It goes back to God, because it always goes back to God. That the God that I believed in couldn't play favorites. Like, the God that I could trust, not only did that God not manipulate free will, right, but that God loved everybody equally. And that meant that that higher power loved every person who had ever abused me, every person who had turned around and walked away and not done something to save me, just as much as me. Okay, that thought pissed me off at first, but then it gave me so much peace. Because it was like, oh, that's what forgiving is. It's equal opportunity. And so I can give her an equal opportunity from this moment on and go forward and not hold it against her, but just to love her equally. So that was a huge lesson for me, and my higher power was what taught it to me, you know. The other thing is about making amends is that sometimes for me, making amends is about what I don't do, not what I do do. And one big thing for me has been my dad. And I do not have a relationship with my dad today. He is not in my life in any way, shape, or form. And let me tell you, that has not been an easy decision. I struggle with that because I struggle with so much guilt and shame about, you know, what a good daughter is. And I hear it all the time. I've heard it so many times. I've had so many people in programs say this to me. Eventually you'll get there and you guys will be reunited. Because a lot of times in recovery, that's what recovery looks like for us. That's what healing looks like for us, right? When we go back and we heal those relationships and we all live happily ever after, you know, yeah, we have our issues and we call our sponsors from the bathroom because they're driving us crazy, but we find peace and we go forward with those relationships. And I just feel it's really important that somebody say that sometimes what recovery looks like is saying, I'm done. And I'm not going to be in that relationship. And you know what? Not only is that the kindest thing for me, but it's the kindest thing for him. Because how excruciating is it to have a yo-yo daughter who's here and now not gone? You know, here and now she's gone, and here and now she's gone. So that, you know, that for me has been another lesson, is that so I don't know what amends are going to look like necessarily, and sometimes my best preconceived ideas are not what it needs to be. Steps 8 and 9 for me are about relationships with other people. It's like, I've got this relationship with God now. Now I've gone through 4, 5, 6, and 7 and found a relationship with myself. Even when I thought I was empty, I wasn't. And now I've done 8 and 9, and I have a relationship with all of you again. Like, I can look you in the eye. I can know that my presence in your life is not going to be destructive, hopefully, for the most part. And that if it is, there's something I can do about it. And then I move on to those maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12. And I have to say, just 10, 11, 12 is really what's helped me truly learn to live, right? First, I had to get a relationship with God, then with myself, then with other people, and then I could get about the business of living. And I learned to start living in my body. Like, my whole life when I was a little kid, all the way up, it was always the body. It wasn't my body. It was the body. It was a tool that was used against me to cause me pain. And it was my preference if it would disappear, right? That whole zero weight. And so in recovery and in program and working steps 10, 11, and 12, and like really getting that daily checklist in place, that daily paying attention, showing up, participating, taking care of myself, exercising, being present in my body, hygiene, learning to brush my teeth and wash my face and take a shower. You guys, for a long time, it was a mental, like it was excruciating just to convince myself to take off my clothes, you know, to get in the shower, never mind actually get in there and use soap and shower, right? So it was a big barrier there, you know, for a lot of things. And that has really been a huge thing for me is that I am a human being, and that human beings come with a body, and that's my body. I own it. It's me. It's all me. I'm me. And I need to take care of myself. I need to take care of myself physically. Part of my tools, you know, when I do my food plan, I incorporate exercise. I incorporate getting enough sleep, you know, taking my care of my intimacy needs, hygiene, medication if I need it. All of that stuff is included in my food plan, you know, and in that daily 10th step and that daily 11th step. And I guess that just brings me to that very last thing is the tools. In other fellowships, we talk about the tools, but we don't enumerate them the way OA does. And I think that is a very unique and valuable and important part of being in OA is the tools. And for me, I find that I need to have all the tools in some aspect of my life. And with everybody that I work with, I find that there's one tool in particular that will be kind of the pivotal make or break. You know, for me, it's plan of eating. I have absolutely need to plan my dinner, just my dinner, for the week in advance, or I am lost. You guys, I walk into the kitchen, I don't know what we're having, and I freeze, and then I leave. I don't eat, right? So that is like my pivotal tool that I have to have. I have to have all of them, but that one's the one that will bring me down if I don't do it. But I know other people have different tools, you know, so that's one thing. I know we, you know, the steps are so vitally important and the traditions are vitally important, but we cannot forget the tools because they truly appeal to the uniqueness of the OA, of the compulsive eating disease. I spit it out. Okay, now I feel like I'm starting to kind of lose like that whole flow, so it's probably time to stop talking, and I really greatly appreciate you guys giving me extra time to talk because it was a story I truly needed to share. Thanks. I don't know. Oh, yeah, did they record that?
We will now open the meeting to questions for the speaker. Please limit your questions to the speaker, Sharon, how she works the steps or uses the tools of recovery. We ask that you raise your hand and wait to ask your question until the speaker calls on you.
You're over. Carrie, were you joking?
I was joking about
okay.
Wait until you call on me. That part.
One, because I know people that are listening to this, because they're emailing me, that they're listening to our speakers. Can you explain, as an anorexic, how you convert, when you sit in the room and most people talk about overeating, how you can convert that to your story or to your duties?
Okay, so the question is, how do you convert, or how do I convert, like the compulsive overeating references to anorexic and how it appeals to me, right? You know, that has kind of ebbed and flowed over time because there have been times when I had to work really hard to convert it, and there have been times when I was bitter about it almost. You know, like here's an example, like when we read the Welcome Home, is that what it's called? The OA Welcome Home from Life. Gosh, now I'm all flustered. When we read that, and they would say, if you've ever been on a diet, and I would always think, well, I've never been on a diet. And I had an OA friend, she's just like, she was like, hit me, like really hard, like hit me. And I was like, what? And she's like, are you kidding me? Your whole life has been a diet, you know, because in my mind, I'd never been on a diet because I had never been on like the, you know, the cantaloupe diet to lose weight. No, my whole breathing was a diet, you know. And so sometimes that converting can be a barrier for me because I just lie to myself and tell myself that I'm different. So then I had to work very actively and convert it. But mostly it's kind of the same way. Like I don't really have trouble converting the alcohol to food necessarily either. And like the efforts that we make sometimes make us giggle. Like when they say alcohol, we say, I don't know, a box of donuts. And I just say, well, I ain't in those donuts, you know? So I don't know if I answered that very well. I think for me, it just has to come down to honesty, like truly honesty. It's like if I'm having trouble converting what I'm hearing in the meetings and I'm feeling different and a part of, I need to open my mouth and say that to my sponsor and say that in the meeting. Like you guys are talking about binging and I don't binge because I starve. And boy, let me tell you, it's converted. As soon as those words leave your mouth, it is converted. So that is the biggest thing. For converting your food, you just got to open your mouth and tell people that you're struggling with the conversion. Okay. I was like, are we done?
Yeah.
All right.
Can you talk about anorexic behaviors?
Not eating. You know, there are a lot of little behaviors, and this was actually a very helpful assignment for me once to sit down and write all the different behaviors that fell under anorexia. You know, I mean, like the obsession about body, and I, you know, until I sat down and really figured it out and, you know, confronted what it was, like, I could tell you, like, every reflective service from the time I left my car to the time I got to my desk all through the office, because I was constantly looking in every reflective thing, trying to get a grasp on what my body looked like. And actually, at one point, it was, you know, very pivotal moment, God moment for me when I was standing in front of the mirror, and I was like, God, just show me what my body really looks like. And the answer came to my head just loud and clear. It's like somebody said it to me. Well, somebody did. But they, you know, the answer came to me loud and clear. It was like, if you want to know what you look like, walk away from the mirror, because you'll never know. But, you know, the obsession about food, obsession about weight, write tiny. Like I would write everything really, really tiny and keep everything very compartmentalized and separated. I never did sauces. I never did anything extra. Like even today at lunch, they were like, what, cheese on that? I'm like, no. You know, no extras, you know, and I'm much better about that now. No food, not touching, lots of rituals, you know, little sneaky trick things. Like if I fill my glass with ice cubes, then there won't be as much milk in it, you know, that contains calories. Like it just very obsessive, compulsive stuff almost. Does that answer it? Okay. Yes. Yeah.
How do you know that you're establishing a connection with God, and how do you know that what you're getting is God's will in your brain, or what have you?
So how do I know if I'm establishing a connection with God, and how do I know if what I'm getting back is God's will?
The ideas.
So this is what?
If, you know, the ideas that are...
If the idea is coming from my higher power or from myself. Okay. So it's really kind of two parts. How do I know that I'm connecting with God? For me, it's a sensation. Like it's a physical gut sensation. Like I feel like my feet are solidly on the ground, even if I'm laying in bed or even if I'm swimming in a swimming pool. I have this sensation of solidness under me about what I'm thinking. Or my gut will kind of twist or feel goofy. I don't know any better way to say that. That's kind of how I know that I'm like tuned in. And how do I know if it's coming from God? Okay. First of all, I guess there's no rationalizations, no question marks, no explanations. Like, it's just a clear, concise answer, no matter how I feel about it. Because sometimes I get a direction and it's just like, yay! And sometimes I get a direction and it's just like, no, I don't want to do it. But regardless of how I feel about it, it's bigger than me. Like, it's just a clear... And you know what? Sometimes God has no opinion. Like, that was really shocking to me. Because I kind of felt like once I connected with my higher power that I should have that sensation all the time. And I was, like, putting it to work. Like, I'd get up in the morning and I'd be like, should I wear red or blue, God? God? You know? And I wouldn't get an answer. And what I've decided is that if I don't get any gut feeling about it one way or the other, then the answer is not that important. And I can go with whatever I feel like. You know, but it really kind of centers around trusting myself. Like, I really have to trust myself and believe that whatever that answer is the right thing. And then the other thing is the acid test for it is to run it past another human being. Like, really, truly, like, on the big ones, not that I call my sponsor and say, red or blue, I don't know. God said red, but I'm not quite sure. But you know what? If God tells me that I should call my dad, you're better damn well be sure I'm calling my sponsor to check on that one, you know? You know what I mean? So those are the two things. It's like, how does it feel inside of me, and then does it stand up to the sanity of another person? Yep.
If this isn't appropriate, don't answer it, but when you said that you stayed here in Omaha after you left Sioux City,
mm-hmm.
Do you have any connection with the people or the life that you had there?
Well, that's a good question. It's not inappropriate because I figure anything I put out there is fair game, right? There's a couple things I learned about that. I went back because for a long time I yo-yoed back and forth with my dad. And I had some sisters, so I go back and forth. I have good relationships with all three of my sisters now. My ex-husband was still there. My children were still there. When I was in the mental hospital, he thought that would be a good time to file for divorce. And for a long time, I was bitter about that. But, you know, in hindsight, hello, good time to file for divorce. Like, right? You know what I mean? Like, for the longest time, I was just like that asshole. But, hello, you have a mentally ill wife who's suicidal in the hospital, has announced she's a lesbian and is leaving you. I think that's the time to file for divorce. You know what I mean? So my kids were there, so I was going back and forth for the kids. Amends actually taught me a lot about that old life. I really firmly believe that you can't truly leave that old life behind. I had to make a concrete decision about each thing in my past. Like, I couldn't just walk away from people and leave it open-ended. I went back to make an amends to a high school friend. God bless her. She loved food. She was a foodie and she loved food. And every day in high school we'd have lunch and every day I would eat half of her sandwich and that was all I would eat. And she was just like, get off my sandwich, you know, and I was like, this is the only thing I'm eating all day. I need that sandwich, right? And I went back to make amends to her for that and other stuff. I don't know, I slept with her husband or something, I don't know, some ugly thing. He wasn't her husband at the time though. That helps. But anyway, so anyway, these Q&A's get you into trouble, man. So I went back, and I guess the crux of, you know, can you leave it behind? It's like I made that amends, and then I think that truly your higher power kind of takes it forward from there. It's like I've gone back and made amends from people in my past and had every intention of now we're going to go on and have this relationship, and it just didn't happen. Like, it just wasn't right. And then I've had people in my past that resurfaced that I was thinking no way in hell that have stayed. So, you know, it kind of, I think as long as I don't run from it and I make myself present, God resolves it. Yeah.
Hi, Timmy. And thanks for your service tonight. I appreciate your sharing your story. My question is, I think this kind of stumped me a little bit, so I'm going to pose it to you. What is your greatest challenge in program today? But then part two, if you, you know, stand in front of the mirror, what would you say today is your greatest strength?
My greatest challenge and my greatest strength. There should be like a prep sheet. These are the top 10 questions you might encounter. Okay, my greatest challenge, I think, is shame and self-pity. Because those are my go-to positions. Always. I mean, like, God, you guys, like, if the mail doesn't come on time, shame, you know, and self-pity. So those are my biggest challenges. I have to always be honest about really what I'm thinking. And a lot of times I'll create really good stories and I'll call my sponsor and she'll just be like, yeah, so you're having some self-pity today. And I'll be like, God damn it, I am. I know that. And then my greatest strength, I guess my greatest strength is being all me all the time. Like being anorexic no matter where I am and not compartmentalizing my life anymore. It's like I am what I am no matter where I am. I'm Popeye. but because that was so much part of my disease. It was like tucking away this part of my personality or that part of my disease or this part of my recovery. And it was all just scattered and yet somehow controlled. So today, if I'm talking to somebody and it crosses, like it's a new person and it crosses my mind that they don't, that they don't know I'm anorexic and I wonder what they'll think of it, I tell them. Then, that moment, I tell them. You know, or if it crosses my mind, gosh, do they know that I'm a lesbian? Like, that's always awkward, like when you have a new sponsee and you've met a couple times and then the question comes, does she know that I'm a lesbian? And is she going to have feelings about that? And is she going to fire me? The second it comes into my head, I say, hey, I got something to tell you. I got to tell you something. And that's my greatest strength, I think. Okay, Sarah.
You talked about, I found it interesting, you talked about disassociating.
Mm-hmm.
You probably don't do that anymore, but like, do you ever find yourself like going like into a fantasy world or maybe like drifting away or how do you keep yourself in touch?
Yeah.
With higher power or making the right calls or decisions or staying.
Being in the present, yeah. Okay.
What are the things you do?
Okay, so for those of you listening at home, the question is, I talked about being dissociative and how do I stay in the present today and okay. Here's the thing, I've never, ever in any program talked about having been dissociative identity. I mean, it's like, hello, my name is Sybil. when I first started coming to meetings and I was in AA and I went to so many meetings a week and it's a big fellowship. It's a lot bigger than OA. You could never get away with this in OA. And I'd go to meetings and I'd introduce myself by all these different names and, come to find out later, they just thought that I was like trying to hide my identity because I was embarrassed, so it worked out fine for me. I integrated in recovery. It was very hard to get abstinent though for a long time, and that was a very long journey. But it began the same way any journey in recovery begins, which was honesty and having to be honest. This is what my body is, so no matter what part of me feels like they're in control, we are doing certain things today. And as far as staying present and not dissociating, I mean, I can't tell you how many dollars I have spent sitting in a therapist's office dissociating, like not being present and paying this poor woman to sit there and watch me space out. And eventually it just kind of started sinking in that this is not very helpful. Like at some point it kind of started occurring to me that, well, it didn't just occur to me, but over time it was like the things that I was trying to escape from weren't here anymore. The only place that they were anymore was in my head. And so there's no reason to escape. There's no reason to leave. So then I started working really hard to be present because lots of things have happened to me in my life that I was not present for because I was starving, because I was dissociating. I have missed out on some of the best things in my life. I remember when I went to buy my house and I went to the bank and did I eat or did I not eat? Now, this is not a very good story because I don't really remember the truth, but I think I ate before I went, and I was just like so thrilled that I was present, that I had eaten and fueled my body to be present. So that has been the biggest thing, is just that reminder of like, if I'm not present, I don't get anything, I miss out. So I work very hard to stay grounded, to remind myself that I'm safe. It is, December 12th, 2009. That's a very grounding for me. I focus on the colors, you know, there's little twinkly Christmas lights, you know, around us. I focus on faces and people. Sarah's here, Barb's here, Julie's here, you know, anything that I can do to stay present. I avoid things like allowing myself to stare off into space. Like if I start to kind of daydream or stare off into space, I'll try to remind myself, oh, come back. Any kind of physical sensations, hand washing or smells or anything like that, those are very grounding for me. Just kind of, I have a lot of tools in my repertoire, but it also really begins with wanting to be here. Because I did not want to be here for so much of my life. Can I answer it?
Okay. Any more questions?
All right, you're turning off. Thank you, guys.